You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Kwame Anthony Appiah writes the Ethicist column, as many of you know, in the New York Times, and he's a writer whose ideas, honesty, and integrity have certainly informed my life, and I think many, many of his readers. His notable works include In My Father's House, which won the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, as well as the Herskovitz Award for the most important scholarly work in African studies published in English. And also the best-selling Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers, the winner of the 2007 Arthur Ross Award from the Council on Foreign Relations. The president of Princeton University has put Kwame Anthony Appiah on the list of people he feels are the world's most powerful thinkers. He is a professor of philosophy and law at New York University and has been inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's received so many honorary degrees, the list is extraordinary. And his latest work, The Lies That Bind, is an incandescent exploration of the nature and history of the identities that define us. It challenges our assumptions about how identities work. And we all know there are conflicts. We certainly know at this moment in our country there are conflicts between identities. But Appiah shows how identities are created by conflict. Religion, he demonstrates, gains power because it isn't primarily about belief. Our everyday notions of race or the detritus of discarded 19th century science and our cherished concept of the sovereign nation, of self-rule, is incoherent and unstable. Class systems can become entrenched by efforts to reform them, and even the very idea of Western culture is a shimmering image. His DNA includes that of his father, Joseph, who was an anti-colonial firebrand and who was ready to give his life for a nation that did not yet exist. It doesn't surprise me at all when I read his work that he has that kind of parentage. Clearly, this great author and deep thinker is writing about what defines this moment for us in America as individuals and as a people. His original thinking, I believe, will help many, many of us. It certainly helped me to articulate what thus far I've been unable to say. And it also gives me great pleasure to mention that the New York Times, in their review of The Lies That Bind, described the book not only as fresh, but beautiful. And it is. Ndejeke Akunile Crosby is a recipient of the 2017 MacArthur Genius Grant, an awardee of the Smithsonian's James Dickey Contemporary Artist Prize. She's been the Woman of the Year for the Financial Times and of Foreign Policy's leading 100, and one of Foreign Policy's description of the leading 100 global thinkers. She was a Mellon Mays undergraduate fellow at Swarthmore College. She spent 4 years at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts and then earned her MFA at the Yale University School of Arts. Her work draws on historical, political, and personal references, creating densely layered figurative compositions that conjure the complexity of the contemporary experience. And I could say just what the New York Times said about I just quoted, it's absolutely fresh and beautiful as well. Among her current projects is an outdoor mural, which many of us have been to see and have loved, and it's just up the street from here, just up 2 minutes from the library at the Museum of Contemporary Art on Grand Avenue. And this mural, if you haven't seen it, please don't miss it. It's up until December 31st. Her forthcoming solo exhibition, which I will also not be missing, is called Ndejeke Akunile Crosby, The Beautiful Ones, and this will be mounted at the National Portrait Gallery in London. We're thrilled to have her here. And finally, Aaron Cristoval, who will help guide the conversation this evening, is a rising star. She's the curator at the Hammer Museum, and I was just there 2 days ago to see her latest exhibition, which is extraordinary. And it's the most comprehensive West Coast exhibition to date of the work of the great conceptual artist Adrian Piper. Aaron Cristoval's exhibitions include Awake in the Water, Mediations on Disaster at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Diaspora and Arts, Memoirs of a Watermelon Woman, and A Subtle Likeness at the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives, an extraordinary place if you haven't visited it, We have some of the collections from one in our own exhibition that's up at the moment in this library, 21 collections, and that's an extraordinary resource for all of us. She's curated Selection, Democracy, Citizenship, Freedom in 2016 at the Los Angeles Municipal Art Gallery, and Baby Boy in 2017 at Transmission Glasgow. And also she's a contributor and curator of the unforgettable Made in LA 2018 at the Hammer Museum, which, as many of you know, showcase artists from the greater Los Angeles area. Please join me. It's a great moment for the Los Angeles Public Library and for the Library Foundation to welcome three extraordinarily thoughtful, talented people with such incredible integrity. And please join me in welcoming to the stage Kwame Anthony Appiah and Djeka Akonili Crosby and Aaron Cristoval.
Hello, everyone. How's it going? Good. Well, I'm so honored to be here tonight with Njideka and Anthony to discuss his book and also Njideka's practice. But I would be remiss to not talk about, just briefly, the firing of Louise Steinman and Maureen Moore. So they, you know, put together this program this fall season that I think is really immaculate. So I would really like to thank them for their service to the public library. And if you're not familiar with what's happening, there's plenty of articles online. So I suggest you guys read up and see what you can do about it. Okay. So I wanted to start off with something that I notice about both of you and sort of your familial background is that your families have both been invested in academia. And I, you know, can't help but think that sort of informed the work that you both are doing. So can you sort of speak to your familial background and sort of how academia had a play in your education?
Okay. Well, thanks very much for coming, and thank you both for being here as well. It's interesting. Technically, neither of my parents went to college. Because my father, who was Ghanaian, got a law degree in London at a time when you got a law degree by doing exams and working with a lawyer, and you didn't go to college. This was a while ago. And my mother got into Edinburgh University to go to college, and then the Second World War started, and she decided there were more important things to be doing. And so she went to Moscow, where her father was the British ambassador, and it was his job to persuade the Russians that they were on the wrong side.
Wow.
So he was there in that period when, after the German invasion, the Russians joined the Allies, and then he went back to England. Mm. And my mother, therefore, was in Moscow and was evacuated from Moscow when the Germans arrived and came back through the world. Went back through Persia. She had a job for the British officer who was running the Persian railways. He was his secretary. And she went around the world and came back to Canada and got back to England that way. But anyway, so she was, as it were, prepared for college and then didn't go. And then after the war, rather than taking that up, she went to art school. Mm. And I think St. Martin's or somewhere like that in London. So, and the worst thing my mother ever said to me was the following. She had these paintings around the house that she'd done. And I said to her one day, "Mom, why did you stop painting?" And she said, "You were born." And I thought, well, that's a heavy load to put on. But she said, "That's okay, because that's why I became a writer. I could be a writer. Mm. I could be a writer with a kid. I didn't think I could be a painter with a kid." And so she became a novelist, and she wrote children's books. And of course, there were books around the house. And that was a little bit unusual, because we lived in Kumasi, which is the second city of Ghana, in an area of town which was the first area of town where kind of middle-class local people lived, mm-hmm. because all the sort of colonials lived somewhere else. So it was called African Bungalows, where we lived, because it was sort of prosperous but not foreign in the colonial period. And we had essentially the library for our street. So my parents had thousands of books in a town in which most people didn't have any books at all. And she had lots and lots of children's books because she was a children's books writer. And so all the kids in the neighborhood would come and sort of sit around. So I love libraries. and I definitely was brought up by both my parents were lovers of the book. Mm-hmm. My father read voraciously and would quote to us from his wide reading, and not all of which was in English. He would sometimes say things to me in Latin, not all of which I understood. So we were definitely brought up, all of my sisters and I were definitely brought up in an atmosphere in which writing and thinking were sort of highly valued and praised. And in fact, we were talking just now about Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist. His book was number one in something called the Heinemann African Writer Series, which is the sort of modern...
I've not heard anybody talk about that series.
But not only was his book number the first of his novels, but he edited it for years and years. And as those books were published, they came into our home. So I sort of feel I grew up with African
West
literature.
Africa.
Yes.
Like when you mentioned Amata Aido,
Yes. Heinemann African Writers Library. Yeah. So anyway, so I think that sense of the book as kind of this precious thing. Mm. They were both Christians, so there was one book that they had a particularly high view of. but they were very broad-minded. My mother, we had the Quran in our house, and my mother said we should read other people's religious books. We read the Bhagavad Gita, we read the Baha'i Allah's thing, the Baha'i text, and so on. So they were very ecumenical. And I remember the first time my mother... in the summer vacations, my mother would put a pile of books upon my bedside table. And I remember the first time that she gave me a book that contained the F word, and I thought, this is from my mother. But, you know, it was a great novel. It happened to have the F word in it. Didn't matter. I was, 15, 14 or something. Yeah. She gave it to me. Anyway, so that's how I sort of feel. Yes, I'm deeply grateful to them for a sort of literary... upbringing.
Mm. Wow, no, that's exciting. I had so many thoughts as you were speaking, and I'll try to hit on all of them. But I wanted to start by thanking everyone for coming tonight to hear us speak. You could be anywhere else on this Thursday night, so it means a lot to us that you came to this conversation. And I also want to talk a little bit about Louise and Maureen, which is that I got an email from Louise earlier in the year, and it was around the time when I felt like my schedule for the year was full. I didn't want to take on anything else, but I made an exception for this because I was so excited by the invitation. Usually when people have discussions with me and ask me about my influences, they're always surprised when I quickly start talking about writers, and I feel like when I'm in my studio, I'm having conversations with writers as much as I am with other artists. And that's a connection that people don't always immediately see in my work. So I was so blown away that Louise thought of putting the two of us together, especially because Anthony's work, Cosmopolitanism, has been very influential to my practice for years. I read it in grad school, and it really just changed my practice. So I was just really thrilled that there was someone who could make those kind of connections, and I'm grateful for that invitation. And Maureen had discovered my work some months ago and had kind of just kept tabs and knew that they wanted to have me at Aloud at some point, and it was just about finding the right time. So I'm so honored that this is the right time and to be here with Anthony and Erin. And one last thing I'm going to add is actually Louise's words in the LA Times did a profile of Louise in 2017, and the title was Louise Steinman Through the Libraries Aloud Program Invites Writers and Thinkers to Ponder LA and the World. And in a video part of that profile, she was talking about what Aloud meant to her and what it's meant to be about and why she started it. And there was this sentence that I really liked. I think is very applicable right now. She said, "I think people want more information and, again, more discussion about what's happening now." So going back to Erin's question, Anthony, I wanted to say what I really loved about your book is how you used a lot of your personal stories to really talk about, you know, quote unquote, identity, and you explain why I'm putting that in quotes. And you bring up your parents a lot and your grandparents, and you even go back to your great-grandparents, and I think that's a connection I have with you is the influence of family in what we do. And even hearing you talk about your parents resonated with me a little bit. So in my work, I am looking at generations and shifts in generations, which is something else that really struck me in your work, just thinking of how things change from time to time. So thinking of my grandparents who grew up in the village in eastern Nigeria, and at least on my father's side, didn't really speak English, never left the village. They spent their whole life there, and that's where they died and are buried. Then going to my parents' generation, which was the beginning of people kind of straddling village and city life. So my parents were born in the village, but they ended up moving to various cities. My mom actually was raised in a northern city. My dad was raised in Enugu, which was a coal city. And so they were raised in cities, but they still had ties to the village. They went there for ceremonies and Christmas and things like that. And then thinking of my generation with my siblings, where we're inhabiting an even more complex space. So I was born in the city, but I spent my summers and weekends in the village with my grandparents. I left my little town when I was 11 and went to Lagos, which is the big metropolis, for boarding school for 6 years. And then after that, left and came to the United States. So really thinking of how, like with each subsequent generation, it gets more broken down. And I mentioned backstage, I have a 22-month-old, and even like thinking of for him, what kind of space will he inhabit? Because now he's an American with a Nigerian mother who might take him to Nigeria, hopefully a couple times a year, and is trying to teach him Igbo. But he, who he is an even more complex space than mine. But another thing that I thought of when you were talking is the connection between our mothers. My mother was a doctor of pharmacology and therapeutics at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka. So I grew up in a university. I grew up in the University of Nigeria Enugu campus. So I grew up in like a university town. But my mother really was the person who instilled in me this desire for a cosmopolitan life. She did have this quest for knowledge and this desire for her children to experience the world beyond what she had experienced. And so something I thought of when you were talking of your mother and her encouraging you to read and things like that was that my mother was the one who applied for the family's green card lottery, which is how I ended up in the United States. And I think it was because she wanted us to experience life outside Nigeria. But even before then, my mother was the one who pushed for all the girls in the house to go to Queens College, Lagos, because one, that was the best all-girls boarding school in the country, but it was also outside of our comfort zone. So the place where we grew up was very homogenous, as homogenous as, you know, homogenous is questionable, which we'll get to later, but almost everybody was Igbo, almost everybody was roughly middle class, which we will discuss later, ? But then when I went to boarding school in Lagos and Queens College, that was my first time really living with Muslims. Nigeria is about 50% Muslim, 50% Christian, but the place where I grew up was almost all Catholic. So just being in a cosmopolitan space where I had classmates who were Muslim, classmates who were very wealthy. We had politicians' children in our school. We had classmates who traveled every summer, which was a very different world from how I grew up. I had no contact with I didn't have much contact with life outside the country. And looking back now, and I didn't realize it then, but years later looking back, I realized that my mother wanted that for us. Mm-hmm. She felt like there was so much more to the world and we couldn't experience it if we stayed in Eastern Nigeria. So for her first push was for us to go to Lagos, and the next push was to try out for us to maybe get a green card and move to the United States, which we did, and that's how I ended up here. And that might have been tied to, she did have postdoc in London, so I think leaving the country really started this desire in her.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I'd like to talk more about family and just these sort of more personal stories, because you know, I feel like in your book, that's a really effective tool that you use these personal stories as a way to sort of talk about broader understandings of race and identity. Whereas in Giudecca, you use your personal family stories as a way to also think about diaspora or this idea of, you know, the post-colonial subject. So could you guys speak to more of why that is a particular tactic in your work? Or more specifically in this book?
I mean, I think that, so I'm a philosopher, and I was trained to think that the way you handle things is by making abstract arguments. And my, I remember, and being good at that. Mm-hmm. I remember my very wise mother saying to me when I was young, you are like my father, my grandfather, her father. You think that if you win the argument, you persuade people. She said, but all they feel is, he's smart, what hit me? and I've learned in a life in philosophy that if I want people to sort of get the points I'm making, it's much better to tell stories. I make the arguments, often I make them, as it were, to myself in order to try and understand which story I need to tell. But I think people understand things better through stories. And the one set of stories we know better than any is our own. In the book, I tell the story of the lives of lots of people, an 18th century Ghanaian who ended up as a professor of philosophy in Germany, somebody who was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and became an Italian without leaving home because of the way the borders moved in Europe. I tell all these stories. I think they're ways of making the point. And certainly, you know, because my mother was a novelist and encouraged us to read a lot of fiction, I do think that that's helped me enormously in my philosophical life, because because the fiction writers are the great experts on telling stories. and if you have, sometimes graduate students, undergraduates ask me how to write better, I say read more. the way you learn to write is by practice. It's like everything, you need just to keep doing it, but also reading, having a wide range of things in your head. So I'm very grateful, as I said before, for that. I think, in my own case, because the topic of much of my work for the last 30 years has been identity, and because in some ways, I guess I'm weird in the sense that it's not terribly common to have an English mother and a Ghanaian father. It's not terribly, both of whom, I should say, it's not terribly common to be the nephew and great-nephew of monarchs, since my last two kings of Asante were my uncle and great-uncle. It's not terribly common to have, in fact, it's unique to me and my sisters to have that and to have a grandfather who, you know, helped create the welfare state in Britain as a finance minister of the Labour government after the Second World War. So I feel weird, but also that's just us. That's what we know. My sisters and I grew up with that. We knew all these people. They were grandparents or my Uncle Matthew was, other people called him Otumfo, which means the powerful one. but he was Uncle Matthew. I suspect it's in part because of the slight weirdness of our background that I thought about these things. Mm. I mean, that was, as it were, what brought me to the subject. And I think now, more and more people live in this way. More and more people live across societies, across cultures. I love telling my students, so my mother was born in England and was English, and my father was born in the Gold Coast colony and was Ghanaian. My eldest sister is married to a Norwegian. Her eldest son is married to a Namibian. My middle sister's married to a nice Nigerian, lives in Lagos, a fine city, though my Nigerian brother-in-law partly grew up in London. And the younger brother of the Namibian married nephew married a Russian recently. So I have a Russian great niece, or half Russian great niece. I have a Namibian, half Namibian great nephew, and I have a half Nigerian great nephew as well. And that's just, I could, you know, my Auntie Grace married a Lebanese, and so on. We seem to have a habit in my family of doing this. But it's happening more and more. And if you think about it, you know, again, my mother grew up in a village in England, and there are a village I've been to very often throughout my life, and there are people in that village who've been there all along, and yet from that very village where my uncle farmed, again, you know, his eldest son married someone from Thailand, and his first daughter married someone from Kenya who was Indian, and so on. So from this tiny village, tiny farming village, too small to appear on many maps, people have sort of gone out into the world, and I think it seems unusual because so many people used to be like your grandparents, people who married in a village and stayed in a village. On the other hand, human beings have always been like this, right? Mm-hmm. They've always been the great travelers. 600 years ago, I'm not very good at math, but anyway, a very long time ago, Ibn Battuta went from Mali to Beijing. And from China, the Admiral Chen Ho went to the Swahili coast, right, in the Ming Dynasty. Alexander the Great went from Macedon to what's now Afghanistan with 30,000 people in tow. So I think we're a traveling species. If you let us travel, we'll travel. That's why I don't like people who want to build all these walls. it's natural to us to travel, and we profit from travel. Of course, the village people... people are entitled to a village life. If people want to stay in villages, you know, humans are different, and different things allow different people to flourish. I'm all for that. And one kind of way of living in the world is to sort of keep to a place that you love and know and are deeply rooted in and where you can go to. I understand this. Mm-hmm. There's a church in England I can go to and look at my 16th century graveyards of my ancestors. I went back to my ancestral village in Ghana a couple of years ago with my sisters and many of my nephews and nieces and my brothers-in-law from Norway and Nigeria to a place where, you know, we've had family since the 18th century. And there are graves there too. I understand. And there are people in that village who haven't been very far away from it. I understand the attraction of those places. But less of the world lives like that than used to. And I think in those places, most of the people now want at least some taste of the world outside. And the reason they don't get it is because they're too poor or because somebody's won't give them a visa. So I think, given that, I think we need a way of thinking about being in the world that acknowledges that there are people who are comfortable in one place and don't want to go anywhere else, but allows that it's perfectly natural for human beings to do this kind of traveling, and that as soon as you give them the technology to do it, it's what they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody, but people from everywhere do this. They just set off. And then our nature is that we find people attractive in other places, and so we have children with them, and the world gets mixed up from the point of view of those who want everything in boxes. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the ways, if people ask, you know, you're asking, you're sort of imagining a world with many fewer boundaries and much more fluidity and so on, isn't that very difficult? One way of sort of saying it's not difficult is to say, look, this is how I live, right? I live like this. I can tell you what it's like. I was coddling my half-Russian great-niece last week in London. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great pleasures of my life is going there to play with her. It works. And, you know, with WhatsApp and Twitter and various things, we can keep track of each other even when we're not together. I see pictures of my great-nephews and nieces pretty much every other day. And they're in Lagos, Windhoek, Namibia, and London. The world has been changed in ways that actually make it easier to do this. When my mother left her mother in England to live in West Africa at a time when basically she had to go by sea, it was theoretically possible to fly, but it was very expensive and difficult. And phone calls were going to cost, you know, the equivalent of hundreds of dollars, so you didn't phone. They wrote each other letters once a week. And there's a wonderful correspondence between these two amazing women. You don't do that anymore. This sense of the newness of this kind of collection is very much in my head because of what happened when I started phoning my mother from England as a student. Every time I called her, she said, "What's the matter? What's the problem?" Because for her, a telephone call was only something you did in an emergency. Now, you know, my sisters will call me up at the drop of a hat. And from miles and miles away. So that the sort of infrastructure for maintaining these distributed families is, you know, now more heavily in place. All these things are easier for people with money, right? I'm not denying that. And it's very important. And that's why, for me, one of the great important things in the world is to make sure that everybody in the world has enough money to live a decent life. And that's my most important political ambition, is to see poverty lifted all around the world, in our country, but in every country. And that's, again, one of the things that I think we can do if we have the right attitude. We've done a lot of it. Hundreds of millions of people have been taken out of poverty in the last two decades. Sorry, this is one of my rants. But and it's because we've opened up the world. And closing down the world again, which is something that our current president seems inclined to do, will be bad for that. It'll be bad for us, but it'll be bad for the world. And I'm an American. I'm glad to be an American. I chose to be American. I'm proud of what's good about my country. I'm also ashamed of what's bad about it. And I think that you can be a good American and also think that it matters that America is a good citizen of the world, that I'm a good citizen of the world, and that Americans should care to make our policies consistent with the general well-being of all of mankind.
I want to say I want to piggyback on, but also say I really love what you were saying about how contact happens so much earlier than people realize. So what you were saying made me think of even when you go back to my grandparents, how we think they lived in this close society, but that wasn't true back then, and you did such an incredible job of kind of like breaking this down in your book, Cosmopolitanism, because my grandmother was wearing fabric, African fabric, that is printed in Holland and shipped to the continent. So it's they're being sold in African countries in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm.
Earlier.
Like 18, yeah, I think it was the company started 1876 something like that. So even when you look at this group, the village people, they had English missionaries that brought Christianity. You start seeing Christianity mixed with their traditional religion to yield something quite different. And so those are things I also explore in my work, because I feel whenever I hit a bump against beliefs in Nigeria with my relatives, there's always this statement of, oh, things can change, it's culture. But that is not true. And you had this beautiful sentence somewhere in here about how culture is messy and it's constantly changing. And it's true. And those are things I feel like I slowly realized, especially at the time right when I left Nigeria. And those are the things I'm trying to put my finger on in my work. And so with my practice, I'm using my personal stories to touch upon all these, so talking about my life in Nigeria and how I was, I'm like this multifaceted character because of all the different places I've existed in, and it made me think of when you talked of your mother leaving her village and going to London and how she was just like a village girl in London. Yeah. And you don't really shed that part of you that was somewhere else. It just kind of builds up on whatever this new place you're inhabiting is, and you become this more complex character. And so with the work, I'm trying to talk about this complexity that more and more people are inhabiting. And it's actually like the complexity of my life builds on the complexity of my parents' life, which builds on the complexity of their grandparents' life. So it's like this thing that increases exponentially. And another thing you brought up that I wanted to talk of, which goes to stories and the power of storytelling and how you can really touch people quickly and effectively with stories, actually reminds me of a conversation I was having with Ken Brecker earlier on in the green room about one thing I found really powerful in your book is that each chapter had a character it was centered around that really anchored the story. So when you talk about color, for instance, you have Amos Affer's story to really bring that home to us, or Italus Severo for country. And all those resonated with me, especially the country thing. Being Nigerian, it's a very complex space. We were not a country till 1914 when this British Lord Lugard decided, I'm just going to carve up this space and call you Nigeria. Whatever falls in there, let it be. Even though there were 200 plus ethnic groups in that area, you do bring up this question, like, what makes up a country? Like, we really do have to start asking these questions. And so I really liked that each chapter had a character, and I almost felt like, and also you were one of the characters in the chapter on Creed. No. Yes.
Well, there was
a little bit of Creed. But the thing that with reading your book is it made me feel like, I always thought my life was complicated. You know when you think like you have a claim on something complicated until you meet someone or read about people who inhabit more complicated spaces and you think, wow.
But I think it's humans are good at this, in fact. You know, as I say, I think so... Here's the thing about the way people think about race, I think, which is sort of connected with this. We have this picture, I think, that until, you know, 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, that until Europeans sort of set out to discover the world, that there were all these people in the Americas, the Indians, and they were just sitting there, sort of, as it were, not doing anything very much. Then there were all these people in Africa, and they were just sitting there, not doing very much. And then there were these people in East Asia, the Chinese. They did a little bit, but still, they were basically all sitting in the same spot, and then and so on. And then suddenly, with the age of exploration, suddenly all these barriers break down, and people start moving around. And so now, so races are the trace of these ancestral populations. This is nonsense. History was going on everywhere all the time. People were moving all the time. The reason why people speak related languages in Cameroon and in Zululand is because of the Bantu migrations that happened long before Columbus, long before the city Columbus grew up in, existed. And then throughout history, people have been moving across Europe and out of Eurasia into Asia Minor, and then, you know, Africa and Asia. Herodotus, a long time ago, said, why do we call this Libya Africa, this Asia, and this Europe? He said, they're all basically one thing. I don't understand it. And furthermore, he said, I don't understand why they all got the names of women. but the point is, he thought that because Herodotus, born in Asia Minor, actually, because most of the Greeks at the time lived in what's now Asia Minor, Herodotus knew, he went to Aswan, so he'd been to Upper Egypt. He knew that the difference between Asia and Europe was in Constantinople, Istanbul, whatever you want to call it, was a swim. And he'd been on both sides of that. he knew that these, the idea that the world was full, was sort of packaged in these three packages called Europe, Asia, and Africa, was nonsense. And so I think it's really important, and that's why you can't use, I think because people have this picture that I was just saying is mistaken, they think there must be some truth to the racial stuff, because after all, these populations evolve separately in these different places. Not so. And in fact, you know, recent work looking at the, we can now extract DNA from skeletons, so we can look at the genomes of ancient peoples. And recent work by people like David Reich at Harvard have shown that these, for example, just a simple example, the whoever was in the British Isles 10,000 years ago, they were all more or less all replaced by some new population, about, I think it's 10,000 years. Anyway, many, many thousands of years ago. So that the population of British Isles, and then, of course, the Danes come, mm-hmm. and the Danegeld, half of what's now England is ruled by the Danes for that period, while Alfred the Great is sitting in the southwest being great. then the Romans come, and from Romans bring Roman citizens. Well, mm-hmm. that means that people came from Upper Egypt to Britain with Julius Caesar. brown people. So there were brown people in England before the time before the birth of Christ. So I think this is just to say that part of the point of the book is that there are these pictures we have that are mistaken, and they lead us to think about the world in the wrong way. And one of the pictures, I think, is that, as it were, history began relatively recently with the European expansion. And that's just not so. And I think it's helpful to let people see that there is a different picture you might have, mm-hmm. which happens to be more accurate, that also allows us to see that we don't have to think of people as divided into these things. We don't have to think that travel is new or that humans are going to find it difficult to make these connections now that we do travel more. I said I went to my father's village, that is my father's ancestral village. He wasn't born there, but it was the family's village. Mm-hmm. I went there for the first time, and I was already more than 60 years old. I'd never been there before. I hadn't been there before because my father didn't want us to go there because they were settled there in the 18th century as slaves, the people who lived there, by an ancestor of mine who had captured them in war. Mm. And they had been obviously freed in the 20th century, and he knew that if he came with his family connection to them, they would not fully appreciate the fact that they'd been, that they were free people. Mm. That they would sort of treat him as if he owned them still. He didn't want to own them. He didn't want to be treated as someone. So he wouldn't let us go. But when I went there at the age of 60, turned out they'd been following us all the time. Turned out they knew about my life. Turned out that when I showed up in the village, they recited my names and sang songs and took me to see my uncle's grave. So I think this is to make a point about the sophistication of village people. Mm-hmm. Village people are not bumpkins. We have this word peasant, which etymologically just means someone who lives in the countryside, but it's a kind of insult. Mm. Very sophisticated people. They understand, and part they're sophisticated because they have something over us, which is the experience of spending your days with people, mostly with people you know very well. So they have an experience of a kind of sociability that's very unfamiliar to us because we live in a world in which every day, today, I've had street interactions with more people than my great-great-grandfather would have seen, you know, in a year. Mm-hmm. Either great-great-grandfather, either in England or in Ghana. So so that sense of sort of settled knowing of a large number of people, which is something that village people have, is not something that most of us have the experience of. So they know something about how to live with people that we risk not knowing.
Yeah, I wanted to get back to this notion of culture is messy, and thinking about the way that you structure this book is kind of a collage where you're referencing all these different people from various parts of history. And in Giudecca, I think that speaks very much to your work and sort of the way that you put together your work, this collaging of images. And I wanted to talk about where these images are coming from, this sort of mass archive. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is actually a good...
They're seeing it up there.
Yeah, I'm trying to find... Which is the clicker? Haha.
There you go. No, it should be...
Yeah, there you are.
Oh, but...
Here, there should be a left and a right on the remote. There you go.
Oh, no. No, I want to have the red, the red clicker. It's here. It's not really... May we have the lights dimmed, please?
Just dim the lights a bit. So it's just be easier to see this picture.
So with the work, I'm really... Let me make sure this is fine. And so with the work, I'm visually trying to talk about this collage of different cultures and spaces. So one aspect is thinking of myself as someone who grew up in Nigeria but now lives in the United States. But even in this work, which is based off a living room in Nigeria, really wanting to use this work to show how even something like quiet Nigerian living room really complicates what people think they know of the space. So, for instance, this is a painting based off my father. This painting is based on my father wearing his Knights of St. John outfit. I don't know if that made its way to Ghana, but it's like we have it in Eastern Nigeria. So just thinking of all these things that one have been transmitted to us or we inherited. Either from when we were colonized, Nigeria was a British colony up until 1960, or through different routes. We also consume a lot of, say, American pop culture. So thinking of this painting of my dad in his Knights of St. John and how when we inherit things, be it pop culture or religion or language, those things don't stay static. They also move in time and grow and become their own thing. So that the rituals around the Knights of St. John in Nigeria is very different from what you'll experience in Rome or, you know, the countries that send these things to us. So my dad is very active in that society, and if you're in it, your wife is called Lady, which makes me think of like weird British aristocracy things that are still vestiges that you find in Nigeria. You have this molding. So this painting is a collage of different houses I've lived in and some things are made up. So this molding in the ceiling is from our current house in Enugu right now, which is like trying to look, I guess, Italian, which is one of the Nigerians, or not just Nigerians, I think a lot of Africans love to signal a connection to modernity or a globalizing world and to show that you... It's part of what shows class, which is one of your headings. So this is one of the things, this kind of like Italian-looking ceiling. Split units, which is a marker of wealth. You use it to cool your house. Having it is very expensive because government electricity is not reliable, so it means you can buy petrol, which signals certain things. There's a lot of religious icons in our houses, just the leftover from missionaries. You have my family picture. You have James Bond. We watched a lot of... and we consumed a lot of movies coming to us from America or the UK. But something I found out when I was trying to find the perfect picture for James Bond, but also doing a project on another painting, was that for some reason, in a lot of Bond movies, up until maybe when it changed to Pierce Brosnan, there were always Blackmore statues in them. And I hadn't even noticed it till I started doing research for this. And that really hit me because it was this thing, we loved James Bond. He was like our beloved. We felt ownership to him, even though we lived in Nigeria. So to see this character that we had looked up to and worshipped and we owned, in Nigeria, you only owned a handful of movies and we owned a lot of Bond movies in like the little handful we had, which meant we watched it all the time. I can sing the whole The Spy Who Loved Me song. and so to like see this thing that was there and we never noticed it. So for me, it was this kind of like how in Nigeria there's always this preferencing or this looking up to the world outside, even though we're not seen the same way. These like chairs that are made in Nigerian crafts, they sell them by the road, but they're made to look like this regal throne chairs. And so the pictures I transfer into the work kind of follows that. So I'm looking for, I don't know if you can see this, but it's a picture of Nigerian lawyers wearing the wig, like British lawyers do, which we actually do if you go to Nigerian chambers, because that's one of the leftover things from when we used to be a British colony. So those are the kind of pictures I'm trying to find, really looking at pictures that show that show the complexity of culture. One, how Nigeria is a combination of the British culture we inherited, the American culture we inherited, but also the 200 plus tribes that Lord Lugard put together are merging into like a weird pan-Nigerian thing, which you see a lot in the traditional fashions and things like that. And the last thing I wanted to point out is the fabric I have collaged in the background is a portrait fabric, and some people also call them commemorative fabric. So this one is a fabric from when my mother ran for office. And I love that these fabrics, you know, every once in a while I come upon objects that seem to recapitulate or really undergird this story of colonial commerce. So earlier on, I talked about how my grandmother wore Vlisco fabrics. Vlisco is the company in Holland that sends us the African prints. But I'm also interested in what came after. The next step is where now you have Ghanaian fashion, Ghanaian fabric industries, Nigerian fabric industries beginning to produce their own fabric using the technique that Vlisco has perfected, but then doing something different. And in that one slight different thing they've done, actually create something that it's now its own new unique thing that they can claim ownership of. And in terms of fabric, is these fabric houses making fabrics where they are using the simple repeat resist wax print method of Vlisco, but they are now putting photographs in them to commemorate weddings, burials, birthdays, political campaigns, whatever you want. But this one little move has created this new culture that is unique to African countries. The only time I've seen portrait fabrics outside the continent was when I lived in New York, in Harlem. The first store I talked to said, they got it from Ghana. It was of President Obama. The first star I talked to said they got it from Ghana. And the second star I talked to said it was printed in the U.S., but they had seen it when they had traveled to an African country. So I'm really trying to speak of that complex space and quickly to talk of this one. So sometimes the work is more focused on Nigeria. Sometimes it's like a mix of my life in Nigeria and my life here. So with this one, this is an image of me with my husband, who is from Texas. And so the dancing figures are based off of Malik Sidibe's pictures from Mali from the 70s, right after, not long after Mali became independent. And there's just this joy and sense of self and freedom you can see in these works that I love. So I'm making reference to those, but I'm also inserting myself in it. I'm wearing a dress that was produced probably within the last 7 years. It's Roxanda. Does anybody know? She's from Slovenia, maybe? But she lives in the United Kingdom. So I'm wearing a dress from her, but I have this hairstyle that is thread. So it's when your hair is partitioned and held together with thread, which in Nigeria is like a very village hairstyle. Yeah, so yeah, it's like a lot of things have crossed over to cosmopolitan culture, but not the threaded hair. And so I use the threaded hair a lot to signal the village girl part of me. So like the person who will have this hairstyle will not be wearing this dress or those shoes. So really using this
items that carry specificity: the hair, the clothes, the shoes, the area where they're in, the plants. You know, cassava plants, I tie it a lot to village life because a lot of their food staple comes from the cassava root. So really trying to pick up different things that speak to the different parts of me to create this composition where if you can begin to break it down, there is just that feeling of things don't quite make sense or this character doesn't fit into any box, I think makes sense. But that goes to this fact of like things are messy and things don't fit into clean boxes. Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, even, you know, the idea that there's the sort of idea of, as it were, unhistorical Africa ignores the fact that this sort of borrowing, which now extends to the world, to Slovenia and the United States and so on, was going on all the time, of course, in Africa all along. So the great art collections of the kings of Dahomey in the 18th century included material from Ashanti, 1,000 miles to the west. As well as it happens in that particular case, a glass carriage from Paris. So the idea, again, in fact, in my hometown, in the 1870s, I think, when the first time the British came in and destroyed large parts of my hometown, there was a building which had been put up by a king because he had had the British Museum described to him. And he thought, that's a good idea. And he had this great building. It's called the Aban, which is the word we now use for government, for some reason, which had Persian carpets, copies of the London Times, materials from the Caribbean, paintings of British imperial soldiers, black people, but from other parts of Africa, and so on, and. As I say, this is pre-colonial. this is people forget that cocoa, which is one of the great products of agricultural products of West Africa, which is a Latin American plant, but it wasn't brought into West Africa by colonials. It was African Ghanaian farmers who saw the opportunity, went and sought the seeds, planted them, created these things, and sold it out into the world. So I think. Now, the two points there, one is, so they were already doing things before anybody came along from Europe. And the second important point is, what they were doing was already connected with the world. They were not just developing local products. They weren't just using things that had developed in West Africa. They were using, these seeds came from a long way away. Kente cloth, which you probably think of as Ghanaian, and so it is, but it's made of silk. There's no silk produced in Ghana. To make Kente cloth, we had to import silk from somewhere. It came from the East. It came from Asia. The dyes had to come from somewhere. Some of the dyes were locally developed, but some of them were imported. We have a wonderful bead-making tradition in West Africa, which many people know about. The glass in those beads was produced by importing across the Sahara from Venice, from Murano, monochrome glass beads, which were then ground down and re-sintered to make the multicolored beads that you see all over West Africa and so on. So, that's creativity, right? Creativity doesn't depend upon just digging down where you are. It depends upon borrowing out into the world. But that doesn't mean that Kente isn't Ghanaian. There's a village where they first did it. Bonwiri, it's a particular place. Somehow they brought this stuff in and did these things. And then people from there, traders, took it out to other people and into the world. One of the great remarks of Gertrude Stein, whom, after all, is a great Californian originally, she was born in Oakland, I think, which I love, is a remark of hers about roots. She said, and this is typical Gertrude Stein because she takes a metaphor and turns it upside down. She said, what's the point of roots if you can't take them with you? I think that's, so you can be, we are rooted in places remote from here, but that we didn't, as it were, we didn't chop off our connection to those places. I'm still connected to the street that I grew up in Kumasi. I'm still connected to my grandmother's village in England and to my grandfather's village, which is separate because my grandmother moved after my grandfather died. And those places are in me and I value them, so, which is one of the reasons why I understand the people who value their particular places and who are a little bit scared by the cosmopolitan. I understand them because of that. But I think one of the great things that we've seen in recent times is a move from thinking that when you move, you have to simply adapt to the place you move to. Right. You have to become, that there's something called Americanization, which means becoming a moderately uptight Protestant. To thinking, look, what's great about this country is a set of political traditions, which it is important right. to understand and appreciate and value if you come mm-hmm. here. But that what enriches us and what enriches Ghana now is the fact that we've got people from all over the place. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful Buddhist temple in Accra from one of the Japanese Buddhist traditions. There's a Mormon tabernacle. There's a Mormon temple in Accra. There's a Mormon temple almost everywhere now. And these things enrich the societies that they come into. You don't have to become anything in the way of religion to fit happily into any modern society. And I think that sense that on the one hand you have to have political loyalties and a political understanding when you move into a society, you have to accept the terms of the democratic terms. That's I believe deeply in that. But the rest of it, we're enriched by letting people bring their roots with them.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I just wanted to ask that to that. I've been thinking of this a lot because it just seems like every few weeks there's a story about someone speaking another language, usually Spanish, mm-hmm. and being questioned about the Americanness is questioned. And those always really frustrate me because it rests on this idea that there is just one way to be American. And it's predicated on this version of the American dream that if you come from somewhere else, you have to reject where you came from. And it's not true. And I feel like early on when I started developing this work, it really came from my trying to say, like, yes, I am American now, but I don't have to give up the parts of me that are like Igbo and Nigerian and grew up in I went to Agolo during the summers and spent my high school years in Lagos. Like, I can be all that and still be American. Mm-hmm. I can be American, comma, Nigerian, and there's not one way to be American. And with my work, I'm really one trying to carve out a way for me to be American as it works for me, mm-hmm. But also trying to figure out a way to be Nigerian as it works for me and believing those are things I can develop for myself and there's not just one way to be that.
Right. I think one of the great things about identity is that on the one hand, collective identities bind us to people we share them with, but on the other hand, each of us puts our own interpretation mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. them.
Right.
So there isn't just one way to be a man. There isn't just one way to be an American. There isn't just one way to be a gay person. There are lots of ways to be all of those things. And in a kind of decent society, we're respectful of other people's choices about how to do this. And of course, that means that they should be respectful of ours.
Right.
And I think, and that can be difficult. It's not. I'm not saying it's always easy. But it's a worthwhile ambition, I think, to say. Actually, this ambition was brilliantly articulated in the 19th century by John Stuart Mill in a book called On Liberty, where he talks about the fact that one of the challenges to people living their own lives isn't just from the government; it's from people around. It's sort of as it were, small-minded people around you trying to keep you, box you in. And he was urging not just that the government should respect our freedoms, which it certainly should, but that we should respect each other's freedoms.
Right.
And I think that part of that is saying, well, even if it makes you slightly uncomfortable, you have to think in the moment that you're being made uncomfortable, well, but that's what she wants. That's how she wants to live.
Yeah.
I think one of the problems with these sort of anti anti sort of Spanish things is that they confuse two entirely different questions, which is, of course, in this country, the English isn't a constitutionally our language, but it is our public language, and we do our politics in English. And if you want to participate successfully in the politics of the United States, English is something you should. So we should make sure that every kid who lives in this country is educated to understand English. But understanding English, believe it or not, is perfectly compatible with understanding a couple of other languages as well. I grew up in a household where the least educated person in the household, who was one of our servants, spoke French, English, his language, our language, and a bit of Hausa, which is a language not spoken by a settled population anywhere within 1,000 miles of us. Humans are good at this, if you let them. Multilingualism is a perfectly normal and natural condition of human beings if it's permitted. Mm-hmm. One of the great projects, this is in the nationalism chapter, but one of the great projects of the 19th century in European nationalism was to eradicate linguistic difference. Mm. In the 1870s, something like a third of the population of what we call France, the hexagon, not the whole empire, but just the European bit, something like a third of the population that didn't speak French. So the state was busy trying to make sure that everybody in France spoke French. When Italy became a country, it was full of hundreds and hundreds of dialects, and they settled on one of them, the Tuscan dialect, mm-hmm. and the Italians themselves started referring to that language, which was a language made for the nation, as lingua toscana in bocca romano, so the language of Tuscany spoken with a Roman accent, or in a Roman mouth, literally. So, you know, in a way, I think that period produced this, same in England. In the British Isles, of course, there's Welsh and Irish and Scots and so on. But the forms of English in Britain in the 19th century meant that you couldn't understand people from other parts of the country.
Right.
And the forms of German spoken in Germany meant that Northern Germans, Prussians, couldn't understand Bavarians. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea of sort of a single language as the thing that goes with a single nation, and that nobody should speak anything except the government language, that's the result of a massive
state project
yes. which was extremely successful mm-hmm. In many places.
It's still ongoing.
And it's still ongoing. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, English is the government language of Nigeria, mm-hmm. right? So in order to do politics in Nigeria, you have both to speak English and, of course, to speak a bunch of local languages. If you really want to get the votes in Igbo land, yeah. you'd better speak good Igbo. Yeah. But that means, yes, the nation needs a language, but it doesn't need to eradicate other languages, right. other people. And Nigeria is a very good example of that. There are hundreds of languages in Nigeria. But spoken very happily and successfully.
Thank you. We are going to open it up to questions, but I just wanted to end on that note, which I think something that this book really hones in on is the notion of a global citizen. And I think that that is a notion that is so important right now, just considering the state of this nation and the notion of democracy and freedom and, you know, what potentially is at loss. So thank you for bringing that notion back into the thoughts of all of us. Okay. So a question behind you.
I agree with you about the benefits of open society, no borders, but your examples, I think that mostly exceptions rather than the rule. You know, I mean, I'm from the old world, from the Middle East myself, and throughout history, we've lived in very tribal, close societies and treated the weaker tribes with extreme violence. You know, I mean, where I come from, maybe till 30, 40 years ago, or until now, very rare inter-ethnic marriage, or even in the United States, you know, early 20th century, it was a taboo for a Protestant to marry an Italian, let alone an African-American. You know, so I think throughout history, people have been living in very tribal, close societies. So it's this idea of welcoming others. I mean, respecting some way, yes, but, you know, welcoming and intermingling with other people from other societies or even other countries, extremely rare, in my view, I mean, throughout history.
Well, I think there's a difference between different kinds of places. So the sort of, let's separate out the question of intermarriage from intermingling, because those are different things. But in a city like Istanbul, especially in the height of the Ottoman Empire, there were people from all sorts of places, and they were living side by side, and they were living in mutual respect within the framework set by the Muslim authorities. Borrowing from and learning from one another. That was true of Athens in the time of Socrates and Plato. They were borrowing, they were learning from the Egyptians, from the Persians. Athenians were learning from Macedonians. Macedonians were learning from Athenians. After all, Aristotle was Alexander the Great's tutor. And Alexander was a Macedonian, and Aristotle was an Athenian. So I think, and similarly, there were these great multi-ethnic empires, like the Chinese Empire, going back thousands of years. I think what's interesting is that, in a way, the modern tensions were exacerbated with the end of empire, because empire provided a framework of authority within which these multi-ethnicities were sort of held in place in their relations with one another. And some of the great tragedies of modernity, starting with things like the Armenian genocide, occurred as the empire's protections for minorities were going away. Empires were actually quite good at protecting minorities. And within the framework set by those imperial structures, interactions between different groups could actually occur. What we need in the modern world is to create analogous structures, not imperial structures, but democratic frameworks within which those kinds of interactions can occur. And we've done that in many places. I mean, the Dutch started doing this in the time of Rembrandt. The Dutch practiced serious religious toleration. The Prince of Orange went to the opening of synagogues. He was the first European monarch, Christian monarch, to do that sort of thing. So, yeah, we've been nasty to each other an awful lot over time on the basis of these things, but we've also found ways of cohabitation which are not just new. I think, as I said, some of them go back into these imperial histories, the Ottoman history or the history of the Russian Empire, and we can build from them. I think the question of intermarriage is a different one, and that varies by societies. That quite a lot of societies have had the habit of actually importing wives from other groups. And that's again a practice that's gone on for thousands of years. But it's true that in a lot of places it has been very frowned upon. One reason it's frowned upon in matrilineal societies, it's frowned upon because if you let women go, their children go with them. But in, for example, Arab society, people have had concubines and wives from all over the place for a very, very long time. The Omanis, if you look at the Omani population, part of the reason why Omanis come in all those different colors is because they had imperial relations with the Zanzibaris and with the Swahili coast, and they married and had children with black people as well as with other Arabs, and for that matter with people from other parts of the what we call
slave trade.
Yes, it was in the context of a slave trade, but as much of the mixing in the Western Hemisphere was in the context of the slave trade, much of the generation of a multiracial population in the United States began under slavery. Then it somewhat diminished because after emancipation, people got obsessed with stopping miscegenation, and so we had a period. In the 21st century, interracial marriage has become much commoner again in the United States. Obviously, no longer within the framework of slavery.
So we have another question right here.
Hi, yes, this question is for Indijeka. I want to hear how there's, of course, this great conversation around the melding of cultures and the globalism of our society. And it also makes me want to get specific as an American can on race, because there's very specific language of race in this society, despite our history and our mix of cultures. And I see your art, and I see the power in it. And I want to pose to you, what, in your feeling, is the voice of an African woman and an African-American woman now? What is its impact in this moment, politically and societally, for us as we're, you know, poised with such a mix and yet such an understanding of the root of even the fact that the first, I don't know if it's disputed, but the fact that the first woman was an East African woman, and just this great gathering of knowledge and this great intersection that we're now aware of as a global society, like, what place do you feel like Black women stand in now in turning things around and moving things forward, or what does that mean? I know it's big, can it mean?
Thanks for asking the question. And I just want to start by saying, this reminds me of the part in your book where the man claims to speak for white men, and you question what does it mean? A white man in the United Kingdom is not the same as a white man in the United States. So I can't really speak for Black women in general, because that's a term that intersects with lots of things. And I think that's why I use personal stories, because I know my life, I know my story, I know what I live, and I trust it, and I can use that to speak about other things, like coming from a formerly colonized place, a globalizing world, being an immigrant. The one thing I do with my work that I think is important is representation. Representation right now, just the visibility of Black bodies, is a very powerful thing. Sorry, I segue a lot to random stories, but right now I have a project up at the Museum of Contemporary Art downtown where the facade of MoCA is covered with a work I put together for it. And that's a project I was very happy to do, and still makes me so glad whenever I think about it, because there is something very powerful about having a contemporary art institution in the United States, spaces that have historically excluded women, people of color, immigrants, and other marginalized groups, and having that institution covered by Black bodies. And so for me, it's also putting out images that I feel I wasn't seeing when I moved to the United States, especially images of a Nigeria that I grew up in. So with the images I put in my work, I started collecting the images about 2009. So I had been in the United States for 10 years at that point, and I really was feeling disconnected from home, even though I went back to Nigeria once a year. Just culture moves so much. Every time I went back to Nigeria, I was encountering a new country, and I felt like this space was moving away from me, because with each subsequent year, it was more and more obvious to the people I came back to that I was someone from overseas, you're not quite one of us anymore. And so I wanted to kind of keep abreast of the changes, especially in the music, fashion, pop culture, and the images were where I did it. But I felt like whenever people talked about Nigeria, I saw pictures of Nigeria, they didn't seem familiar to me. And so it just started with me thinking, like, there is this country I grew up in and I encounter every time I go back that has this incredible fashion, music, literature, that is really unique, even though even though it's referencing a lot of American pop culture, it takes from that, but really creates its own unique thing that is really amazing. I think it's such an incredible space, and I wanted to put it out there. And so that's where I'm coming from. And the one thing I wanted to add is a quote I think of in my work a lot and kind of drives my practice. And when I think of urgency in my practice, I think of this George Gerbner said that representation, sorry if I mangle this, but representation in the fictional world means social acceptance, and absence signifies symbolic annihilation. And this ties back to, like, why is it important for me to put out these images, not just of black bodies, but also images of black women, especially, I only have 4 images, so you can't really get a sense of my body of work, but usually it's black women in position, not just positions of power, but black women who clearly, like, exhibit agency in their life and just have a certainty about them in their space and in the body they occupy. So just putting that out there to counter all the narratives that are there is, I think, is important. I don't know if that answered your question. Okay.
We'll take one more question.
To go along with that, you talked about us being comprised of our hair, our clothing, and our shoes. Would you explain your hair and your scarf and your shirt and your shoes?
No, thanks, I will. I actually, there was a word you mentioned in your book that starts with an H that I thought spoke to this.
Hexis, bodily hexis.
Yes. About, like, I think of specificity as my analogous word. But the way I always think of it is, the example I always give is, when you're in Brooklyn, or like when you're somewhere in the world, do you ever have that moment where you see someone walking down the street and you think, that's a European tourist? But you guys have had those moments. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, like, you know, my husband always tells me, like, people know you're an African woman and not an African American, even when I don't have my head tie. And I'm very fascinated because I always want to answer that question. What is it that gives it away? And it's not as easy as you think. It's not. And it's a very fun challenge for me to do, or for anybody to do. And so for me, where I live in the United States, but I go back to Nigeria, the game I play with myself when I go back home is, can I fool people into not knowing I came from abroad? And you think all you have to do is speak Igbo, because I'm very fluent in Igbo, but it's not. And sometimes people will... So the one funny story I tell is, I went to the market and I was talking to this guy and we were speaking Igbo, and I thought I fooled him. He doesn't know I don't live here. And, you know, haggling is like a game and you have fun doing it, and we're bargaining and haggling over prices. And then he finally goes, like, in my language, like, my sister, why are you doing this? You have dollars. And I like came back home and I was talking to my mom's assistant, and I said, like, he said I have dollars. How did he know I don't live here? And she looked at me and she just went, your shoes. Yeah. And I had, like, these shoes that I thought were really funky and African. But she was just like, no Nigerian girl will wear that. But I hadn't even been aware of it. So I love how those little things... I have my husband's good friend was born in Egypt, and he also does the same thing when he goes back. And he said once someone told him it was the way he sat, which made me go back to this. So sometimes it's like the way you... My brother went home with his 7-year-old child, and it was the fact that his son looked at adults and spoke to them without being spoken to first. So they're like little things in the way you dress, the way you act, that really begin to show if you've been in a space or if you're coming from outside the space. And so I like being able to pinpoint those, because I feel like if I can name them, if I can put my finger on it, then I can actually play with them in my work, and I can begin to create... So what does it mean if I have a character that has this, like, village hairstyle, but she's sitting in a way that will signal that she really is not from this society, or, you know, she doesn't live here anymore. And so, like, people who can begin to parse it out will just feel like something is not quite right. Yeah, and I feel like usually I do show that even in the way I dress, not all the time. When I'm going to the studio, I just look like a I'm never going to go there. but when I dress, sometimes I notice that even in what I wear, without thinking too much of it, speaks to that. This is an outfit by a Nigerian British fashion designer called Duro Lowe, who makes his own prints, but it's kind of like trying to reference African prints. And then, of course, the head tie is something my mother did, and I picked up from her. And then, like, jeans, universal.
Yeah. Okay.
But I did like that word. So what was it again?
Bodily hexis. From Bordeaux.
I just wonder if you could talk about it a little bit, because I thought that was so fascinating. I was just like, oh, my God, this is it. This is it.
Well, I think it's just the way in which our bodies, including our mouths and the way we talk, reflect unconsciously our sense of who we are. And we're human beings are incredibly good at detecting subtle differences in bodily hexis. And that's one of the great identity markers, one of the great mechanisms by which identity is communicated and boundaries are maintained, is, doesn't have to rise to the level of consciousness. You just know from the way somebody talks that they're not from here. and it can be a class, it can be racial or ethnic, it can be national, but it's a very important feature of how identity works, and it's one of the reasons why I think it's important for people to spend time with people of other identities, is because otherwise you don't get used to differences in bodily hexis, in these different ways of behaving. And so then when you meet someone who does it another way, you're sort of put off.
Well, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Njideka. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Great.
Anthony will be signing his book out front, just so you know. Thank you all for being here.
And Njideka will be giving away painting.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.